Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
What is up, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. Danny, what's up, my friend? How are you?
Chilling, man. As per usual. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good, besides my voice, which I noticed. Probably clearly hear. I've been sick for the past week or so that's why we're late with the episode. Well, I'm still sick. Damn fucking flu, man. Everyone in New York has got some type of sickness, or at least everyone I know.
Yeah, I mean, I was traveling for the Thanksgiving, and a bunch of people at my job were sick. And when we came back from break there, pretty much that first Monday, like over half of my meetings were canceled because people were out and sick and stuff like that. And I was like, yes, extra day.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. Well, you know, my wife's a teacher, so She brings home every single sickness known to mankind back. And
known to children.
Known to children. So I'm sick. My son has been sick, and which was extremely scary. Mm-hmm. He wasn't very sick. He just had like a low-grade fever, and, he had the sniffles, but he's 6 months.
It's the first time he got like sick.
And it's the first time that he's been sick. And of course, I feel extremely guilty because I'm most likely the one who got him sick because I was sick first. Mm-hmm. But that's the worst part. Like seeing your kid sick, you're like, I'm like, what did I do to you? Especially when
you gave him some antibodies.
That's true. But he's doing fine. He's okay. We're all right. I've just been, my voice just sounds super nasally. So hopefully people can bear with me today, but
that's all right. I think the content's gonna be interesting enough where we can overlook your nasaliness.
Overlook? You mean over here? All right. Well, the show must go on, and we've taken too much time between our last episode, and we need to get something out. And honestly, this was taking me a pretty long time to do the research on, because it's a touchy subject. And, you know, when you formulate your opinions and what you're going to say, you want to do it without being insensitive. And I mean that, like, I'm not even trying to be like, you know, too politically correct. When it comes to religion, I have absolutely nothing against religious people or people of faith. I actually have a lot of admiration for people of faith, especially when faith enhances somebody's morality. I'm very envious of that, and I think it's great. But today we're going to be talking about Christian Zionism. And the reason why I wanted to do this episode is because, well, first and foremost, I listened to Daryl Cooper of the Martyr Made podcast and his series on early Zionism.
Fantastic, something by the way.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and we've been recommending it to everyone. It's a 5-part series or 4-part series on basically the history of the Zionist, the early Zionist project, all the way up to 1948, the birth of the nation, and then it stops there. Then it doesn't go on anywhere else. It's just the early Zionist project in the 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. Fantastic, and something I never realized, and I really learned from that show, where it was how many British political elites were subscribed to post-millennialism. They were sincere Christian Zionist, like Lloyd George and Mark Sykes, who co-authored the Sykes-Picot Agreement.
Right.
And
we're gonna definitely define what millennialism is and also post-millennialism, but just obviously it has nothing to do with like the the generation.
Yeah, we'll get into that and cover the basics, but going back to Lloyd George. Something funny that I learned about him was that Mark Sykes's son, Christopher Sykes, was actually one of Lloyd George. Why am I saying Lord George? Lloyd George's biographers, and he was writing that his advisors were trying to debrief Lloyd George on you know issues in the Middle East and Palestine. And he just really wasn't able to grasp what his advisors were saying. Like, he just was drawing blank stares. Like, he just didn't understand the Middle East whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I'll quote right from him because it's a funny quote. "Largely because he could not move beyond the Christian Zionist worldview of his youth, when briefed repeatedly on the contemporary geography of Palestine, Lloyd George insisted on reciting from his memory of childhood Sunday school lessons from biblical cities and lands of the Bible times, some of which no longer existed." And this is coming from Mark Sykes's son, Christopher Sykes, who was the main biographer. And you know, Christopher Sykes is coming from a Christian Zionist family as well. So the whole dynamic is really interesting, and the history behind it's really interesting. The Christian Zionist movement in England really started to work with the political Zionist movement that was emerging out of mainly Central and Eastern Europe. The other reason why I wanted to talk about this was is really Mike Johnson.
Spirit House.
Mike Johnson, the new Speaker of the House. He is one of the many Christian fundamentalists who serve in Congress. He had previously worked as a lawyer for Ken Ham. And Ken Ham is a creationist from Australia, who now he lives in the U.S., but he was a founder and president of Answers in Genesis, which is an organization that argues that the Earth is 6,000 years old.
And so Mike Johnson and is or was his lawyer?
Yeah, was a lawyer for, served as a lawyer for him. Huh. This is a creationist group. They have a complete literal interpretation of the Bible. And Mike Johnson had actually helped him secure government for government funding for a Noah's Ark amusement park.
Oh, that one?
Yeah.
The one where they build that giant ark? Where was that? Like Tennessee or something like that?
I think it is. I think it's Tennessee.
It's Kentucky. That is correct. Sorry, it's Kentucky. It was one of those.
So Mike Johnson worked on that as an attorney. But as you can imagine, Mike Johnson is a very extreme Christian Zionist. He believes that Israel and the Jewish people are God's chosen nation, and that they're going to play a pivotal role in the end times spoken in the book of Revelations. Now, needless to say, Johnson's top donor is AIPAC. And he has very deep ties to the Israeli right. He goes back and forth to Israel. He works with radical settler activist groups. One group specifically called 12 Tribe Films, which is kind of like a film production company. Right now, the Likud crowd believes evangelicals are really the backbone of Israeli support in the U.S., and that focusing on strengthening that relationship at the expense of American liberal Jews is really just a numbers game. So, surprise, surprise, the very first thing Johnson did after becoming Speaker was put forward a bill affirming Congress's support for Israel. And I don't know if you saw, but Congress just ruled that anti-Zionism anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism the other day.
Mm-hmm. I did see that.
Which, you know, say what you, we knew that they were going to do that, but it's just,
I mean, like, this know, is it, one of those very distinct moments where, you know, I don't know how to react to that, because on the one hand, I want to be like, I don't give a shit what you think, you know? But on the other hand, it's setting, like, I mean, there's no like legal precedent or anything like that. You know, you can't go to jail for not for being against Zionism. But yeah, I mean, it's weird.
It's weird, and you know, Zionism is a political ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Judaism is a religion,
right?
And conflating a political, conflating a political ideology with a religion in itself, in my opinion, is anti-Semitic. But you know, you can be the judge of that. But you know, my big point is that when you see Congress people base their foreign policy on the plot of Left Behind movies, it's mm-hmm. a little concerning. Have you ever seen the Left Behind movies?
Yeah.
I watched with Kirk Cameron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right though. It is a little concerning.
When you're basing kind of real issues of the state of war and peace on prophecy, it's not great.
Yeah, I mean, all those movies are basically like conspiracy
Christian
thrillers.
Goofy movies. They're very goofy movies, and you know, they're bad. They're not great. They're poorly acted, and they have these goofy storylines. But yeah, it's a little strange.
Maybe we should take a step back, because I think it's kind of hard for a lot of people to grasp the concept of like what Christian Zionism is, because shouldn't Zionism be like a more like a Jewish thing? How are we defining Christian Zionism here?
So Christian Zionism is it's Christian support for the Zionist cause, specifically they support the return of Jews to their biblical homeland in Israel. I'll quote Paula White, who is the advisor to the White House on Faith and Opportunity Initiatives. And I just took this from, I was just scrolling through israelsallies.org, and it, you know, labels the top 100 allies of Israel of 2023. And each one had a quote next to them. So the top quote, so Paula White says, "My deeply held faith and conviction has aligned me to stand with and support Israel in every possible way. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob made a covenant with the Jewish people and promised them a nation. That nation, Israel, is the foundation and birthplace of my Christian faith. I also stand with Israel for geopolitical reasons. Since 1948, the nation of Israel has been America's staunchest ally in the Middle East. I proudly support Israel and the Jewish people." And really, this website, like every single quote is basically the same as that, but maybe a little bit different wording. Mm-hmm. This lady is a fundamentalist Christian Zionist. Fundamental Christian Zionists believe the return of Jews to Israel is a key step towards the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Most importantly, the return of Jesus Christ.
Mm.
And in the words of John Hagee, the well-known televangelist, the final bullet point of his pamphlet on why Christians support Israel is, "We must support Israel's right to the land because God said so."
Because God said so. I think they're probably, you know, they're pointing to God's covenant with Abraham that was described in Genesis 13, and believe this covenant extends to pretty much all Jews. So in Genesis and also in Exodus, God promises the land of Canaan to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, so that the modern state of Israel is basically a fulfillment of these prophecies for these, you know, Christian Zionists. Thus, you know, Israel is the only nation on earth that's basically created by a sovereign act of God, which is fascinating. We talk a lot about like what makes a nation, and in this case, this is the first instance that we're talking about one that, you know, where we're saying like literally God made it. Anyway, Ishmael, who's the father of the Arab nations, was not included in this promise.
Yeah, though he, Ishmael, yeah, Ishmael receives a blessing, but he's not he is not included in the promise of land.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's passages in the book of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. They describe a future return of the Jewish people from exile. They believe that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was a significant step forward to fulfilling these prophecies. You know, Ezekiel 36 and 37 in particular, they describe the gathering of the Jewish exiles from all nations back to the land of Israel. So Christian and Zionists interpret these chapters as foretelling the return of Jews to Israel in modern times.
Okay, I mean, this is like really hard for me to stomach because, I mean, first of all, I'm not particularly religious at all, which is no surprise. But it's hard because, you know, it's like the Noah's Ark Museum, right? The Noah's Ark Museum is this museum that's purporting, among many other things, that like the Earth is like 6,000 years old, right? As it relates to you know, these prophecies in the Bible, are we saying that these folks are taking these words as like literal truths in this sense, like that the, you know, 1948 establishment of Israel is like a literal interpretation from the Bible?
Yeah, so they're dispensationalist. So dispensationalism, yeah, dispensationalism is a theological framework within some branches of Christianity, for the most part in evangelical and fundamentalist circles. It involves a belief that history is divided into distinct dispensations, which are periods during which God interacts with humanity in different ways. So for most fundamentalists, there are seven dispensations, but I mean, depending on what church or what congregation you go to, there could be more or less, but generally that there's seven dispensations. So seven times to like organize the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, the first one is innocence. So the innocence is the time of Adam and Eve. So humanity was innocent and lived in a sinless state. Then there was conscious, and this was, you know, the time from Adam to Noah, and it was when humans became conscious and they became aware of good and evil. I'm not going to go through all of them, but there was promise, and that was the time from Abraham to Moses, and this is when God made his promise to Abraham and his descendants.
Mm-hmm.
We live in the period of grace, and grace is the time from death and resurrection of Christ until his second coming.
Okay, so zero onwards.
Mm-hmm. So the final dispensation is millennium, where Christ comes back as described in the book of Revelation.
Okay, so millennialists are, what was that word
post-millennial
from before? Post-millennialists are saying, you know, they're after the period where Jesus comes back, you know, as was described in the book of Revelations. That's where that word comes from.
Yes. That's gotcha. So before Christ returns, there needs to be a period of trials and tribulations.
Mm.
So God's justice needs to be executed on earth. But first, both living and deceased, so true believers, will be taken up to meet Christ in heaven. And they will escape from earth before the period of earthly tribulation. And the period of earthly tribulation is going to suck. It's going to bring tremendous suffering. There's going to be plagues. There's going to be natural disasters. And then there's going to be the rise of the Antichrist.
Well, if we're playing this game, we can argue that we're already in the the earthly tribulation phase, which would mean that the rapture, which is when everyone gets taken up to see Christ in heaven before the tribulations, has probably already happened.
Was that COVID?
I don't know. I'm just
COVID
saying.
COVID was
like,
the rapture.
You know, well, if we're see I, again, this is me. I'm not a theologian, and I certainly don't study the book of Revelations, but, you know, like you said, there's this period of trials and tribulations, right? And we have a group of folks, these Christian Zionists, these fundamentalists who believe quite literally that the word of God, you know, is actual truth, and that we've seen it in the past as happened, like 1948, the establishment of Israel is like the, you know, one of those turning points that was foreseen in the book of Revelations as one of the prerequisites to start the end times. So if that were the case, right, and one of the things that is foretold to happen is this period of earthly tribulation, I guess if I were one of these folks, I'd be arguing that we are now in the period of earthly tribulation. But before the earthly tribulation happens, the rapture had to have happened, which means that if we're currently in the period of tribulation, that the rapture already happened and all the people here were not saved. So it's very, I don't know, it's very interesting when I think about it out loud.
Like, yeah. So basically the people who are followers of Christ will be just, they'll fly to heaven.
Right.
They'll fly up to heaven and they'll be greeted by, they're going to go into an otherworldly realm and meet Christ. Everyone else is screwed, including the Jews. Unless they convert to Christianity, that's what the end game is. But what they believe what will be one of the big signs is a one world government with the Antichrist. And I find the concept of the Antichrist so funny, because I just remember back when Obama was president, I think my mom was like, I think Obama's the Antichrist.
Right. Right.
I think
Trump was the Antichrist.
Yeah, Trump was the Antichrist. I mean, I don't know. How could you see Biden as the Antichrist?
Well, some people do. Do you remember that picture of him in front of the White House, or he was in Philadelphia, I forget exactly, but he was in front of those white pillars and they put up the red in the background, but really it was like red, white,
dark
and blue.
Dark Brandon.
Yeah, it looked like, you know, super sinister, like, oh, look, this is the
devil. Yeah, it was very sinister. That was a very Antichrist type thing, but he's just too old and feeble to be the Antichrist. Has to be like this charming guy.
Yeah, cunning. Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's why I feel like if anyone was going to be the Antichrist, well, people said Bill Clinton was going to be the Antichrist.
Well, he did get that blowjob in office.
They said that Obama was the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm. Everyone's the Antichrist.
Everyone's the Antichrist. You ain't cool unless you're the Antichrist.
Right. I'd suppose that Alexander Millet, that guy from Argentina, have you heard about this guy yet?
Yeah, I know who he is.
He's making some waves. I bet a bunch of people are thinking that he's the Antichrist as well. It's like pretty much anyone that's famous and is in a position of power that's in any way like polarizing.
I'm sorry, but the president of Argentina is not the Antichrist.
Dude, ask some Argentinians.
Yeah, the president of Argentina is not the Antichrist. The president of the United States could be the Antichrist, but not of a South American country. I'm sorry. Sorry, no offense, but your country doesn't matter enough to be the fucking Antichrist.
Dude, I've been reading some shit. Like, people actually think he's like literally the devil incarnate.
All right. When Argentina conquers the rest, or he becomes president of the world somehow, then maybe we can have that discussion. But come on. Let's reserve the Antichrist title for actual people with real global power.
Right. So, Biden.
But all right. I digress. Back to the period of tribulation.
Right.
So the culmination of the tribulation is going to be the Battle of Armageddon, which involves all the major powers. And this is when the second coming of Jesus is expected to take place, where he will return to earth to establish his kingdom. He'll defeat evil forces, and then he'll bring about a new era of peace.
Right. Yeah, this religious conception of the final days of mankind—it's a scenario that's mapped out by all of the three Abrahamic, you know, religions in extremely similar detail. There's this huge focus on specifically the Temple Mount, and more specifically, who controls it. So for the Jews, you know, the Temple Mount is the site of the first temple of the Hebrews that was destroyed by the Neo-Babylonians and then again by the Romans. According to the Jewish traditionalists, the third temple will be built by the Messiah, who will not only be the king of Israel, but also a high priest of this new temple that they'll build. So until then, no religious Jew is allowed to set foot on the Temple Mount for fear of desecrating the sacred ground, which brings up a lot of, you know, contemporary, you know, issues, right? Like part of the grievances as set forth by, you know, Hamas and why they did their October 7th, you know, attack was, you know, affronts on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which happens to sit on top of the Temple Mount, right? Really right wing Jewish folks going there and praying, which was apparently supposed to not be a thing. Anyway, I digress. There's been fanatics in Israel who have plotted to speed this process up and get to creating that third temple by basically destroying the Dome of the Rock. But those attempts have been thwarted by the Shin Bet. So for the Muslims, though, kind of bouncing back and forth here, the Temple Mount is the site of the Dome of the Rock, which is a Muslim shrine. The sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque is, you know, the place where Muhammad, in the Quran, that Muhammad mounted a fine Arabian horse and galloped straight into heaven accompanied by Jesus, which is very interesting. So obviously extremely holy for the Muslims as well as the Jews, but also it's important for Christianity. In this dispensationalist view, Jesus returns to earth to do battle on the plain of Armageddon and triumph over the Antichrist, but only after building the third temple. So the dispensationalist Christians have to work to see Israel, Jerusalem, and the Temple Mount are all under Jewish control, because they believe that this will lead to blessings for the entire world as nations recognize and respond to what, you know, God is seen to be doing in, you know, in and through Israel. And I guess, you know, the way that I interpret all of this is that, you know, the fundamentalist belief that God is working through Israel, you know, is present in the mindset of these Christian Zionists.
Yeah. So God is working through Israel.
Correct. So I'm curious, because I haven't done too much research on this. I know you've done a bit more. What specific, like, sects or strains of Christianity, like, follow this belief?
So, I mean, a lot of Christians do, even Catholics, some Catholics do, but it's I would say Christian Zionism is most relevant within mainline evangelical and independent denominations, including Assemblies of God, Pentecostal, Southern Baptist, as well as a lot of the, you know, independent mega churches. You know, these views, I mean, over the past decades, there's been these large Christian radio stations and TV stations. What's that one channel, Mile High or Mile 7? You know, I'm talking about that like late night Christian news channel that comes on.
Oh, the 700 Club, is it?
700 Club, yes.
That's the one.
Yeah, 700 Club. So I was watching a 700 Club once, and they were talking about Israeli politics with, like, way more, and I'm not even, they were biased, but they were talking about, like, detailed Israeli politics to the point where I was kind of impressed, like, how much they knew about, like, well, you know, this guy's head of, you know, Meretz party is not the first. It was, they like had a lot of, they've had like a lot, some big segments on Israeli politics where they had like a lot, where you're going to have get a lot more knowledge than watching CNN. It's always going to be like, we got to support Benjamin Netanyahu in the Likud party. But it's really interesting to watch.
This is the show that had Pat Robertson.
Pat Robinson's on that. So I have a quote. So Dale Crowley, who was a Washington-based religious broadcaster, he called them the fastest growing cult in America. It's not composed of crazies so much as mainstream middle to upper middle class Americans. They give millions of dollars each week to TV evangelists who expound the fundamentals of the cult. They read Hal Lindsey and Tim Leahy. They have one goal: to facilitate God's hand to waft them up to heaven and free from all the trouble, from where they will watch Armageddon and the destruction of planet Earth. So, some of the largest donors to Israel are groups such as Christians United for Israel, the International Christian Embassy of Jerusalem, Bridges for Peace. There's dozens of these Christian Zionist lobby groups, but without there's more money going through the Christian Zionist groups than like AIPAC when it comes to supporting politicians. Without the sustained financial and political support of Christian Zionists in America, the state of Israel probably wouldn't exist anymore. But let's just be real. Without that bedrock support in the U.S., it probably couldn't. Mm-hmm. And for many evangelical Christians in the U.S., the birth of modern Israel in 1948 was viewed as a fulfillment of prophecy. So the creation of Israel, along with the perceived communist threat in the Cold War, is what really galvanized fundamentalist Christians and conservative political forces in the U.S. Old Testament prophetic chapters found in Ezekiel were interpreted so as to predicate a Soviet attack on Israel in alliance with a world led by the Antichrist.
Mm.
So Israel was at the center of the future prophetic scenario, thus providing both political and theological rationale for Western Christians to give maximum support to Israel. Another big event is the Six-Day War, because the Six-Day War is even more relevant than the 1948 war when it comes to Christian support for Israel. Mm-hmm. Because when Israel captured Jerusalem and the West Bank, along with the Gaza Strip, the Sinai, and the Golan Heights in 1967, the fundamentalists went wild because the land expansion and above all the reunification of Jerusalem appeared as nothing short of a divine miracle.
Mm-hmm.
So Nelson Bell, who is the editor of the evangelical journal Christian Today, wrote shortly after the war that for the first time in the more than 2,000 years, Jerusalem is now completely in the hands of the Jews, gives a student of the Bible a thrill and a renewed faith in the accuracy and validity of the Bible. So the fact that, you know, that Israel was expanding was prophetic, was a sign that their convictions were true.
It's when you look at it from that frame of reference, it seems to be plausible, at least if you were of the persuasion that you know the word of God is in the Bible and it's all true. Then looking back and looking at 67, yeah, that would make me feel like, yeah, this is like the proof is in the pudding here. But I mean, it took like thousands of years to happen, right?
One of the big Christian Zionists of the 70s and was a guy named Hal Lindsey, and he wrote a book called The Late Great Planet Earth, and this book sold 25 million copies. It's one of the best-selling books in history.
Okay.
And it was all about, you know, support for Israel, and it was basically like kind of a new spin on like the traditional dispensationalist beliefs. But it's really interesting how this era, and I also think, I mean, U.S. support for the Christian right support for Israel, I think goes beyond most Christians in America today are not fundamentalists who believe, like, you know, the Bible as literal. I think a lot of the support for at least the older generation comes from Cold War politics.
Yeah.
But this one with combined with,
well, I mean, it was like a bit of a concoction, right? Like you said, when you put together the idea of the fundamentalist Christian beliefs and the ideas that, of comparing 48, you know, to a fulfillment of prophecy in the Bible, and there's also rampant, you know, phobia against, you know, Soviets and communism in general. You put both of those things together, and it makes for an easier thing to swallow. Now you got two things: or you're not super religious. Well, how about this communist thing, right? You're not super political, and you're very religious. So how about this religious thing? You know, it just worked well together.
And honestly, most Americans have Jewish friends too. You know, yeah. Or most Christians have Jewish friends. So it's like, you know, it's pretty easy to support
Israel. Easy to get on board with, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to get on board with. So,
want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
So where was I? So yeah, following the 67 war, Israel gained an increased portion of U.S. foreign and military assistance. And, you know, this is when Israel really becomes that Western pillar of the strategic alliance against the Soviet Union in the Middle East, with the Iran under the Shah holding up the Eastern pillar.
Mm-hmm.
It was during this period that AIPAC and other pro-Israel lobbies began to increase their power and influence on U.S. foreign and domestic policy. And they noticed the natural affinity that fundamentalist Christians had with Israel. So one of the most significant political components in the emerging alliance was the unseating of the Labor Party, which had been the dominant political faction since Israel's inception or creation in 1948. The Labor Party dominated. They were unseated by the Likud Party when Menachem Begin became president in 1977. And Menachem Begin, he allied himself with the Moral Majority Movement in the United States. You've heard of the Moral Majority, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They were, you know,
the evangelical group, right?
Yeah. So they were kind of like the neo moralist, you know, fighting against what they saw were abominations and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
In 1979, you know, Jerry Falwell founded the Moral Majority, which was a lobbying group whose purpose was to promote the pursuit of conservative and Christian and family-oriented legislation in U.S. Congress. However, the most important issue was the destiny of Israel. And, you know, they were big time advocates for the Israeli state. Falwell and Menachem Begin were close friends, or they became close friends through their, you know, their shared lobbying. Mm-hmm. And in forming this relationship, Begin and you know, fellow Likud member Ariel Sharon were able to gain support for their ambitious settlement policies at a time when Likud's settlement policies faced a lot of resistance from Jimmy Carter and even to a lesser degree Ronald Reagan. Begin could consistently rely on the ideological support from Falwell and the evangelical moral majority. But it's really during the 1980s, you know, the 1980 election, it was estimated that over 20 million evangelical Christians voted for Reagan. And Jimmy Carter was a Southern Baptist evangelical.
Yeah, that's crazy. This guy's an actor.
Yeah, I mean, Democrats traditionally were voting for Democrats mm-hmm. in the past. And one of the reasons why is because Jimmy Carter was showing limited support for some sort of Palestinian state. You know, he was against expansionist settlement policies. And it was during the Reagan administration that the Christian Zionist right really became the absolute dominant strain of the GOP. Like, look at any congressman or senator in the country on the federal level. You'll find more diversity on the state level, but on the federal level, it's virtually every Republican many Republicans are fundamentalist Christians.
I'd venture to say the majority of them are
with dispensationalist views. Mm-hmm. I mean, Thomas Massie voted against the anti-Zionist, anti-Semitism
that's good
bill. And AIPAC, has already spent, or pro-Israel groups have already raised like hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to remove him with negative ads. Yeah, it's crazy. I'm not sure what the exact amount is, but at last I checked, it was something like over $100,000 and trying to remove him from office. So, I mean, there are some, but not every Christian subscribes to this too. It's still kind of a minority, but it's just a motivated one. And honestly, something else is that this is something that's more of an older phenomenon. I think it's like 50 or more than 50% of evangelicals who are, I think, millennials and younger don't support Israel. So the parent,
according to this newest House resolution, does that make most of those people anti-Semites?
Yes.
That's wild.
I mean, just saying Benjamin Netanyahu is a horrible prime minister of Israel
makes you an anti-Semite.
You'll be called an anti-Semite. So,
I mean these labels are stupid. There were people who believed that statement, you know, before the House made this resolution. But now I feel super weird about it, because it's now like, does this mean that the current House of Representatives would collectively consider people who were against Netanyahu as anti-Semites? Because that would make you and I anti-Semites. You know what I mean? According
that
to
would
the
make
House
most of Israel anti-Semites.
Yeah, right. Right?
Like let's just be real. This guy's hated right now. This guy's on his way out.
Yeah.
This guy is seen as letting, as falling asleep at the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
They're already in a state of cold civil war prior to the attack on October 7th. Most American Jews hate him. Like, this is not a popular guy. Mm-hmm. But we can say it over and over again. Criticizing the way that Israel was created, with the expulsion of the native population, and the continued political situation with Palestinians having no rights is, if criticizing those two things makes you anti-Semitic, then I don't really know what to say. Like the most prominent critics of Israel are American Jews. So I don't even entertain it. Like, it's not even something, it's so dumb, it's impossible to entertain. Because real anti-Semites will let you know that they're if you ever talk to a real anti-Semite, they just can't wait to like find something in common with you, and so they can be like, oh man, like, yeah, Hitler, like, they can't wait to like show you, like, you know, like, Hitler actually had some good ideas. Like, they are excited. Yeah. They'll let you know.
Right.
So that's what I have to say about that. But I don't entertain it because it's just so dumb. It's so dumb. So now,
well, let's let me get back to the point. I think we're venturing off. Christian Zionism. Like, when do you think the Christians start believing in this?
So, all right, this is a complicated question, but it goes back way further than American evangelicals. Hmm. So these interpretations of the Bible, the interpretation that the Jews should be living in their historic homeland, they predate political Zionism, the political Zionism of Theodore Herzl of the 19th century.
So Christian Zionism is technically the original Zionism, is what you're saying?
Yeah. So to a degree. So Christian Zionism is, they're kind of like proto-Zionist, because at least the theological, and I'm not sure, you know, I'm not an expert on Judaism, you know, if there were Jewish thinkers who were, I'm sure they were talking about going to Palestine and creating a homeland, but none of that really, you know, made headway until the Zionist movements that were secular and more nationalist gained momentum in the 19th century. So I have a quote from a British Anglican priest, Stephen Sizer, who's also he's a historian of theology
and theologian.
Theologian. I'm sorry, my voice is making me not pronounce things correctly. The road to Balfour began in the Protestant Reformation. The Reformation brought about a renewed interest in the Old Testament and God's dealings with the Jewish people. From Protestant pulpits right across Europe, the Bible was, for the first time in centuries, being taught within its historical context and given its plain literal sense. At the same time, a new assessment of the place of the Jews within the purposes of God emerged. Pure in eschatology was essentially postmillennial and believed the conversion of the Jews would lead to future blessings for the entire world. By the late 17th century and right through the 18th century, especially during the period of the Great Awakening, postmillennial eschatology dominated European and American Protestantism. So, like you said, in a way, the Protestant Reformation was really the genesis of Christian Zionism.
Or Zionism in general.
Yeah, or Zionism in general. And I don't know if I'm going to go too into this because it's complicated, and I fully don't understand this topic. But, you know, European Protestant churches, people were hearing the Bible preached in their native languages for the first time. Mm-hmm. The Bible was being taught in
their languages as well, and so the few people who could actually read their native language and maybe not Latin could actually now read the Bible themselves.
Yeah. But a thing that's important is that, you know, there wasn't this, you know, the layman could interpret the Bible to his own devices.
Right.
Which
when it went all downhill when all the normies got a chance to start.
Yeah, the barrier of entry, they reduced the barrier of entry. And whenever you lower the barrier of entry, it, you know, things usually get worse, right? So, but the trend is that the Bible started being taught in more of a historical perspective rather than in a moralistic perspective. And, the trend was that leaders like John Calvin encouraged believers to interpret scripture with the help of other parts of the Bible, trusting that scripture itself would provide the best guide to all of its meanings. This meant that when they explained the Bible in their sermons, they made sure to cover everything that God had said. So this included talking about the history of the Jewish people and the special promises and the consequences they had based on, whether they were loyal or obedient to God. And because of this new interest in ancient Israel, people started to understand Romans 11 in a different way. And, Romans 11 is a chapter in the New Testament by the Apostle Paul. It addresses the question of the status of the Jewish people and God's plan for redemption. The church had been dealing with the status of Israel and God's salvation plan after the rejection of the Messiah. But for many years, the Roman Catholic Church, they understood Romans 11 to mean that the church included both Jewish and Gentile believers, and that's actually what represented Israel. Mm-hmm. However, after the Reformation, Protestant churches started to think differently. They believed that the verses referred to Jews who hadn't become followers of Christ. So this new perspective on Romans, I think it's 9 through 11, was a big shift from the way that the Western churches had been teaching it for centuries. Mm. And, as soon after, when it comes to like the Puritans, they started suggesting the idea of like a renewed Christian Israelite nation. So, there was a difference in, I guess, the way that all this was really interpreted by clergy. But I guess the big question was when this became part of like, when people in power in these countries started subscribing to these interpretations of the Bible.
Right. And I think like the big players here, obviously there's folks in the United States that were, Christian Zionists, but I think the big power players here, especially in the creation of the State of Israel, was the British elite circles. You know, when did Christian Zionism start like going around those British elite circles?
So in the early 1600s, the political class in England started pushing the idea of bringing back the Jews to their homeland. A key member of Parliament named Sir Henry Finch, he wrote a book called, and bear with me right now, The World's Great Restoration, or The Calling of the Jews and of All the Nations and Kingdoms of the Earth to the Faith of Christ.
Wait, that's one book title?
That's the title of the book.
Jesus Christ.
I thought they had a limited amount of paper back then. I guess did as much as they could on
that. Let's see.
I'll let you count.
Word count.
Before I forget what I'm going to say. In the book basically suggests that the Jews should go back to the promised land and then reaffirm their connection to it. But he wasn't talking about rebuilding the temple or bringing back the old religious system. Instead, he wanted them to follow Christ. So he wanted them to convert and then go back to their homeland.
Mm.
Now, this was still on the fringe. This was like a fringe thing. Most Englishmen did not share the view that this view for restoration of the Jews to Palestine, but this even included King James. King James forced, he disavowed them and basically censored him. Nevertheless, the idea grew significantly with the rise of postmillennialism in Puritan circles. And since American Puritanism was largely drawn from England, this is how that idea made its way to America.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I want to jump around a little bit. I know we've been talking about, how the different U.S. presidents might have been the Antichrist. but, you know, there's this thinking in the late 18th and 19th century, you know, in the aftermath of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, that, you know, that there was this rise in apocalyptic and post-millennialist thinking, and some religious thinkers began to interpret Napoleon Bonaparte as the Antichrist. So it's fascinating how this trend, you know, of, you know, powerful people being, you know, associated with potentially being the Antichrist, you know, goes back quite a while. Some religious thinkers, you know, were making an interpretation that was based on the upheavals and the conflicts of that time with, you know, Napoleon's conquest seeing as like basically aligning with this like apocalyptic narrative of, you know, one world government, which Napoleon was definitely after, you know, or more accurately, probably like a 10 nation confederacy in the book of Revelation. Victoria Clark documented this, you know, excitement in the Times. She said, Napoleon also had his own version of a Jewish state in Palestine that was subservient to the French. So yeah, I guess in this way, Napoleon believed that with a compliant population of Jews who controlled Palestine, that the French imperial and commercial interests that stretched as far as India or Arabia and Africa, that it could be more readily secured. You know, so here's a moment in time in the not so distant past, where again we're utilizing the area of the Levant as a foothold for, you know, for Eastern colonialism. You know, so neither Napoleon nor the Jews though were able to deliver on that. Obviously, you know, they did. No one ever set up a French run, you know, Jewish state in Israel. Nevertheless, though, his proclamation is a quote barometer of the extent to which European atmosphere was charged with these messianic expectations. But I mean, you could guess how he changed the zeitgeist. Napoleon, that is, you know, Napoleon arrested the Pope at one point, and he annexed the papal states, and he also began like this systematic destruction of the Roman Catholic Church in France, you know, just seizing its assets, executing priests, and again, exiling the Pope from Rome. You see, he's doing some pretty Antichrist-like shit, you know? By 1815, he basically subjugated most of Europe and the Middle East, so there's that one world government thing. And his plan was to create a United States of Europe, which, you know, where each state was run by a like a compliant monarch, and you know, basically he would be the supreme king of kings and sovereign of the Roman Empire. So, you know, pretty strong case for Napoleon, more so certainly than Biden. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, he's definitely more of a Napoleon's definitely more of an Antichrist candidate than Biden. Yeah. That and I don't know. I want to do an episode on Napoleon as the Antichrist and like look at and just review like a bunch of the writings of that day, like freaking out thinking that he was the Antichrist, because I think it would be pretty funny.
I'd have to crack open Revelations again and start, you know, piecing together the different ways that he would be the Antichrist, but yeah, that could be interesting.
But I guess going back to, you know, where you know, the British circles, if there's one proto-Christian Zionist thinker that you need to know, because there are many of them. The most important one was the British preacher, or it might have been British-Irish, John Nelson Darby, who was one of the most influential preachers theorizing about the rapture and the periods of tribulation. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a zealous missionary who funded churches across Europe and the United States. He spent a lot of time in the U.S. late in his life. I think he kind of lost favor with a lot of people in England, so he was forced to stay in the U.S., where he really impacted a lot of the evangelical leaders that come out of America. I guess most importantly, C.I. Schofield, the writer of the Schofield Anointed Bible. Zionism most likely would have been simply a religious idea if it weren't for the intervention of a handful of influential aristocratic British politicians who came to share the same theological convictions as Darby. One that's really important to know is Lord Shaftesbury, who was a British Tory politician, and his name will come up if you read anything about Christian Zionism. Lord Shaftesbury, I'll quote Don Wagner. "One cannot overstate the influence of Lord Shaftesbury on the British political elite, church leaders, and the average Christian layperson. His efforts in religious political thought may have set the tone for England's colonial approach to the Near East, and in particular the Holy Land, during the next 100 years. He single-handedly translated the theological positions of Brightman, Henry French, and John Nelson Darby into political strategy. His political connections, matched by his uncanny instincts, combined to advance the Christian Zionist vision." So he was a post-millennialist. He fully expected that with God's help, men like him could move history towards the millennial period and the kingdom of God on earth. And he became convinced that the restoration of the Jews to Palestine was not only predicted in the Bible, but also coincided with the strategic interest of British foreign policy. So after the Napoleonic Wars, the British became obsessed with keeping the French and the Russians out of the Middle East. So Lord Shaftesbury, he argued for a greater British presence in Palestine by sponsorship of the Jewish homeland. And British protection of the Jews would give a colonial advantage over France for the control of the Middle East. It would also do things like provide access to India, via direct land route. It also would open up new commercial markets for British products. But, this view, pre-millennial dispensationalism was very much a minority view. But now there was a practical and political reason to advance this ideology.
That's the key right there, I think. Honestly, out of all the stuff that we've been talking about today, it's really not necessarily by itself that, you know, a number of people just suddenly became incredibly fundamentalist and started believing that, you know, there was this word of God that had to be upheld or had to be expedited, right? I think it's the intersection right here, the geopolitical intersection, that makes it really take off. The idea that once there was a practical political reason to advance this idea, once there was that synergy, that's when this takes off. I think that's the most important point.
Yeah, it's all about connecting the political with the theological.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then making it convenient. Because once you make the religion convenient for a political aim, then you can use it.
Yeah.
It'll catch on faster.
Yeah.
It becomes real.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing about Shaftesbury is that he came up with the slogan, "A country without a nation for a nation without a country."
Okay, that's troubling.
which isn't the same thing, but it inspired the Israel Zangwill and Theodore Herzl phrase, "A land of no people for a people with no land."
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. This guy died before Israel existed or even the Zionist movement really took flight. He died in the late 1880s, but he's certainly the grandfather or of British Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is important to note is that all this discourse is taking place prior to the term Zionism even being a thing. So the term Zionism was not coined until 1885 by the Austrian Jewish writer Nathan Birnbaum. And Birnbaum had been a leading spokesman for the Jewish national homeland prior to Herschel entering the picture. You know, Herschel got involved in the Zionist movement while covering the Dreyfus Affair as a journalist. You know, the Dreyfus Affair was when a Jewish French lieutenant was wrongly convicted of treason.
Right.
And the whole situation sparked this ugly wave of anti-Semitism in France, a country where Jews were comparatively well integrated compared to, you know, Eastern European countries or territories in the Russian Empire. But from this event, he was convinced that the Jews of Europe just had no other options. Like, you know, the wave of anti-Semitism that kind of spiraled from that moment was pretty terrible. So you really get when you, the thing about the whole, you know, even though I criticize Israel a lot, I always think of myself, man, if I was a Jew in the 19th century or the early 20th century, I would be a hard, not just France. France is a better place to be a Jew, but like, especially if you were a Jew in the Pale Settlement or just anywhere else, I would be a hardcore Zionist.
Yeah,
hardcore
probably.
Zionist. Like, how could you not be an extremist?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I always, basically getting bullied all over Europe, you know?
And, yeah, and, it's know, like, you, how you do you not want to advocate for a national homeland?
Yeah.
You know, people changing their names and stuff and, you know, just being treated like second-class citizens. Like, that's, it's absolutely justifiable why the project started.
It makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. And on top of that, it's being egged on in favor by the people who basically don't like you. You know, the people who want you out anyway, they love the idea of you leaving, you know?
Yeah.
So again, it's another one of those intersections of the kind of fundamentalist ideology and like a practical political, geopolitical, like, you know, idea.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah.
That's how it kicks off.
So, you know, Herschel is elected president of the Zionist organization in 1897. And by 1897, Jewish leaders who favored a Zionist state had already won the support from many important senior British political figures. And this was largely due to a man named William Heschler. And Heschler was an Anglican priest. He became a chaplain in the British Embassy in Vienna in 1885, which put him in connection with Theodore Herschel, who was based out of Austria. And Heschler was a crusader against anti-Semitism. So he had, you know, he basically was honestly more of like a humanitarian. So he had reached, you know, the conclusion that, that Jews would never be safe in Europe. You know, he's like, these people need a national homeland. And, you know, he became the, you know, Herschel's chief Christian ally in realizing the vision of the Zionist state. Mm. So he was one of the only Christians invited to attend the World Congress of Zionists. I actually have a quote from Herschel about him, which was, so Herschel wasn't religious, but he was superstitious. And he recorded, you know, he records a meeting with Heschler in 1986 in his diary. The Reverend William Heschler, chaplain of the English embassy here, came to see me, a sympathetic, gentle fellow with a long gray beard of a prophet. With the long gray beard of a prophet, he is enthusiastic about my solution of the Jewish question. He also considers my movement a prophetic turning point, which he had foretold 2 years before, from a prophecy in the time of Omar. He had reckoned that at the end of the 42 prophetic months, total 1260 years, the Jews would get Palestine back. This figure he arrived at was 1897 or 98. So 1897 was the year that Heschler expected the Jews to begin their return to Palestine. And then here's another quote. Herschel described their second meeting at Heschler's apartment. Herschel was amazed to find the books from the floor to ceiling, nothing but Bibles, and a large military staff map of Palestine made up of four sheets covering the entire floor of the study. He showed me where, according to the calculations, our new temple must be located, in Bethel, because that is the center of the country. He also showed me models of the ancient temple. We have prepared the ground for you, Heschler said triumphantly. I take him for a naive visionary. However, there is something charming about his enthusiasm. He gives me excellent advice, full of unmistakable, genuine goodwill. He is at once clever and mystical, cunning and naive. So it's just funny, like the, you know, the personalities, because I think Herschel was, Theodore Herschel was an atheist. Like he was, you know, he didn't really care about the religion of Judaism. It was more, you know, Zionism doesn't really take the characteristic of a religious movement at all. It more or less takes the character of the same type of nationalist groups that were going on in the Russian Empire and Prussia and places mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah. It's a quasi-nationalist idea.
Or an Austro-Hungarian Empire mm-hmm. or the former Ottoman states. Like, it's the same thing. It's just, you know, this state is in a different continent, you know?
Yeah.
This state that we're going to is different. It's in a different continent, and there's other people who live there. So, but yeah, his, you know, Heckler's, you know, diplomacy made a radical shift in the Christian Zionist thinking away from the views of early restorationist who saw restoration to the land as a consequence of Jewish conversion to Christianity. Heschler was insisting instead that it was the destiny of Christians simply to help restore the Jews to Palestine rather than to convert them first. Then there's David Lloyd George, and which I started off with the quote with David Lloyd, someone about Christopher Sykes's quote about him, mm-hmm. which I found humorous. But I have another quote, because David Lloyd George was the prime minister of England after, you know, during during World War One or 2 years into World War One in 1916. He became prime minister, and he was prime minister when really the Balfour Declaration was took place. He was a big Zionist too. And he, here's a quote from him: "I was brought up in a school where I was taught for more about the history of the Jews than about the history of my own land. I could tell you all the kings of Israel, but I doubt whether I could have named half a dozen of the kings of England, and not more of the kings of Wales. We were thoroughly imbued with the history of your race in the days of its greatest glory, when it founded the great literature which will echo to the very last days of this old world, influencing, molding, fashioning human character, inspiring and sustaining human motive for not only Jews, but Gentile as well. We absorbed it and made it part of the best in the Gentile character." Hmm. So him talking to, I believe he's actually talking to, you know what? I didn't get that part of the quote, but I just thought it was interesting. And then, of course, the, you know, the other big Zionist, Christian Zionist was Arthur James Balfour, who pioneered the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary at the time. And like Lloyd George, Balfour had been brought up in an evangelical home and was sympathetic to Zionism because of, you know, the influence of the dispensationalist teachings. So, you know, these are the people. It really comes out of the British. It's the British political class influenced by this, you know, Puritan view of the Bible, combined with the political aims of a national group, is what created the modern state of Israel. It's interesting.
Yep. In particular, I think after having this chat with you, Henry, I think I'm pretty settled on it's that intersection. I can't get that out of my head, you know, between the fundamentalist ideas, you know, the theological ideas, and the more, you know, practical or pressing, you know, geopolitical functions. And I think, you know, when those two get together in these various points of history that we discussed, it promoted the idea of Zionism. And it's interesting to make those comparisons today, you know, just thinking about that out loud. Like we didn't really get too much detail about it, like the contemporary reasons why Zionism is super useful, except for in the very beginning of the conversation where we're talking about things like, you know, Mike Johnson, right, and how much money he's getting from AIPAC, right? But I wonder, you know, now that we've spoken about how the religious component syncs up with the geopolitical components, like what are the different ways today that Zionism is working in that respect, particularly in the U.S. Like what is the intersection today, do you think?
Man, that's a big question. It might be served better for another day, because I'm getting kind of tired. But I would say that I don't know. I think it's complicated because there's so many different motivations. Mm-hmm. At this point, most people in America are not fundamental evangelicals. You know, most people around the world generally are becoming more secular.
Yeah.
Or not attending church. I don't think most people are like, I think most people's, I guess in terms of, so you're asking why, what's the political advantage of supporting Zionism now today?
Yeah. And how that intersects well with just, the religious one, you know?
I think a lot of it, when it comes to politics, it's just that there's a lot of money. There's a big consequence supporting Israel if you're in federal politics. the Israel lobby is extremely powerful. It has multiple parts, including a Christian Zionist part, and it can cost you your political career if you're not actually. It's cost many political careers. I mean, George Bush Sr. blames the Israel lobby for him not being reelected.
Here's one. I can build on what you're getting to. I think one way that there's that intersection for me is how these people will utilize a fundamentalist Christian ideology as almost the pretext for which to support Zionism, to support, you know, Israeli, you know, interests. But in actuality, it's that intersection of perhaps they do hold those beliefs religiously, but in truth, or in more practical sense, they kind of have to, right? They specifically, as you pointed out in the beginning of the show, the Republicans kind of have to, because if they don't, then they're not going to get any money, or, you know, in some cases, you know, might be actively sabotaged for not holding those political beliefs. So, you know, the intersection there for me is, okay, you might have those Christian beliefs, but also, you know, it serves you to promote the Zionism politically.
Yeah, it's a lot of atheists support it too. It's just a matter of like it's just a lot easier for your political career to not piss off a powerful lobby than to do so. And also a lot of the Israeli foreign policy goals and a lot of the Israel lobby goals, they line up with other lobby interests, specifically the arms industry. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what, you know, I think the best description of what the neoconservative movement is, the intersection of the Israel lobby with the military industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, those are two very, very powerful groups. So if you are not going to take money from them, or if you're going to, you know, oppose them, then they'll fund your competitors or, you know, smear you with all sorts of things. So, you know, there's not that much political hope. Like, we'll see how Thomas Massey deals with this.
Yep.
But I'm tired and
so am I.
I got the flu. And speaking about controversial subjects, when you're getting tired is usually not smart. So I say we end
probably
this.
Probably not. Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening to another episode of Bro History. It's always a pleasure to have you listening. If you like the show, you can rate and review the podcast on Apple or on Spotify. You can also join our Patreon, and then you can also join our Slack when you join our Patreon, which is our very fun community where we continue the discussion that we're having. Danny, anything else?
Nope.
All right. Peace, guys.
Peace.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. New episodes drop every weekday, so listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts.